Welcome to Charles's Illustrated History of the Fax Machine. This week, we'll be looking at toner. So if you could open your manuals to page 294 and look at diagram B3. That's the one next to the one-time offer for the Mary Queen of Scots commemorative oyster shucker. $23.99 plus tax and shipping, not available in Nebraska, only available with a background check and a reference from your social worker in California. I know that I've missed a couple of weeks, but I do have some exciting news for you that will hopefully make up for lost time, which is that this episode, and this episode only, will be available in the form of a 600-piece jigsaw puzzle that has been personally and lovingly painted by Luther Abel's own hand. This puzzle will feature all of your favorite characters from this installation: Bugsy the Piranha, Ed the Lonely Toaster, Ginterbrand Mouse Practice, and friends. It'll depict lions and tigers and waiters carrying mineral water, and in the upper right-hand corner, there'll be a vignette of Michael Brendan Dougherty writing a check for his latest water bill. They say that Luther is an artist, but really, he's much more than that. He's an artist with two T's. And maybe a coffee if the paint fumes begin to lull him to sleep. This week's show is brought to you fully pre-assembled and lightly waxed by our two sponsors. This is the How the World Works podcast from CEI, and the new book, Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life, by David Barnson. And of course, as you'll know, our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute are back with new episodes of their breakout How the World Works podcast, hosted by author and political commentator and sometime guest on this show and my former podcast partner, Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to that show, you should be. For each episode, Kevin sits down with notable guests for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives. From flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm to leading special ops missions in far corners of the globe, some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that inform their outlook on life and their future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, both of whom are old friends and colleagues of National Review, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in the media. So be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit cei.org/How the World Works, which is cei.org, How the World Works. Before I get to my guests, I want to recruit your help. Not this time to leave a glowing review of this show on Apple Podcasts, although you absolutely should do that too. How's that for some preterition? But to help me work out the rules of the how many states have you been to game, which seem to change from person to person and thus make direct comparisons quite difficult. So by my count, I have been to 44 of the 50 states. The six I'm missing in no particular order are Iowa, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Hawaii, and Montana. Now, for me, it's not especially difficult to definitively say that I've been to those states because I've quite literally never been there in any capacity. I haven't landed in them, I haven't driven through them, I haven't even extended a toe into them at the state line. I am, in every sense you look at the question, completely Iowa-less. I am a stranger to Hawaii. I'm an Oakloutsider. Where it gets trickier, though, is the other 44. Specifically, insofar as what counts as a visit. So my rule is that you have to affirmatively do something in the state to say you've been there. Spending the night counts, but only if you leave the hotel. A meal at a restaurant counts unless it's by the freeway, as does attendance at a sporting event or an amusement park, or time spent at the home of someone who lives in that state, or a meeting in a city or a town. Driving through without stopping does not count, and stopping for gas doesn't change that. And nor does catching a connecting flight at an airport. I suppose my rule is a little like the NFL's rule on what counts as a catch. Per the official regulations, a wide receiver has to A, secure control of the ball in his hands or arms prior to the ball touching the ground, and B, touch the ground inbounds with both feet or with any part of his body other than his hands, and this is the key part, C, after A and B have been fulfilled, perform any act common to the game, e.g. tuck the ball away, extend it forward, take an additional step, turn upfield, or avoid or ward off an opponent, or maintain control of the ball long enough to do so. To say you've been to a state, you have to perform any act common to the state. So it can be hard to describe that, but I think you know it when you see it, or at least I know it when I see it. But perhaps you think I'm wrong. If you do think I'm wrong, then let me know, and I'll read out any compelling alternative approaches that I find interesting at the start of the next show. I'm also interested to hear any stories from people who've been to all 50 states, in particular about how they got their last state. I've been on 44 states for quite a while now, and I'm keen to get to 50, but I suspect it'll take some time. I've been half-minded for a while to take a fortnight off and just go see the last six and then write about it, but it's quite hard to do that when you have kids. I also suspect that if I were to pitch this to National Review, they'd probably laugh me out of the room. Anyhow, let me know, and also let me know if you're currently on 49 states. Stuck. Hopefully, if you are, the state you're missing isn't likely to secede. But if you want to succeed, even I need a drink after that segue. Nevertheless, if you want to succeed, which you should read the new book by David Barnson, Full Time, Work, and the Meaning of Life. It's a terrific book, and it lines up closely with the ethos of National Review, and of me, frankly, which holds that work is a bedrock in a flourishing society. It's a pivotal component in the God-given dignity of every person. And in the book, economist and financial manager David Barnson, friend and colleague here at National Review, has taken that message to its full potential. Whether it be in public policy, in the culture, or even in the church, too often work is seen as a necessary evil, and not as the universal blessing that it is. And David argues for the economic, theological, and ontological significance of work, suggesting that it is core to our identity, and that the fastest way to a failed state will be to continue in a low regard for work that ignores our God-given capacity for productivity. David does not shy away from defending work as a therapeutic, cathartic vehicle for dealing with challenging circumstances in life, and he ultimately argues that the other things we value in a well-ordered life, such as marriage and children, community worship, are all enhanced when we properly prioritize and centralize work. This is not the sort of book on work you've read before, but you should read this one. And you can get the book by David Barnson, Full Time, Work, and the Meaning of Life, today at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, or wherever fine books are sold. Or you can look it up at fulltimebook.com. My guest today is Rob Frommer, a senior attorney and the director of the Institute for Justice's Project on the Fourth Amendment. Rob, welcome to the Charles C. W. Cook podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, well, you have a story to tell me, and I won't give any of it away. I will let you set the scene right from the beginning of the movie. Take it away.
All right. So, listeners, this is back in March 2021, beginning days of the pandemic. All of a sudden, the FBI decides to raid U.S. private vaults This is a safety deposit box company that rents to individuals. And there are over 800 boxes on the site. And as you might suspect, some of the people who rented there were ne'er-do-wells. And there were investigations of those ne'er-do-wells over the course of the years. But the FBI got frustrated. It decided it wanted to take down the whole business. And so it applied for a warrant, a seizure warrant, for the company's assets. They were saying that the company was helping facilitate things like money laundering and drug transactions. But what they didn't tell the judge when they were applying for the warrant is that they didn't just want the business's property. They wanted all the property of everyone that was in any box. In fact, months before they even applied for that warrant, the FBI had already had internal discussions where it had decided that it would attempt to forfeit. That means use courts of law to permanently keep anything they found in a box that was worth more than $5,000. Now, you're saying to yourself, but they don't know who these people are. They don't know if they did anything wrong, and that's exactly right. But the FBI didn't care. As long as there's $5,000 worth of stuff in there, they were going to take it and try to keep it forever. And why $5,000? Well, that's because that's the amount set by the FBI and the federal agencies in order to ensure that they make money on the deal. In other words, the government came in there with a plan to break open 800 boxes, try to steal everything they could that was worth stealing. Ultimately, they tried to forfeit over $100 million in cash, gold, and jewels from hundreds of innocent people, including some of our clients. And that's when we knew we had to step in.
So let's go to the beginning there. The FBI has a meeting and it contrives this plan. Why? In the FBI's telling of this, what was it that led to this project in the first place? Was there one particular box in this business's ambit that they suspected had something absolutely terrible in it? Or was this just a guess?
This was the latter. This was a guess. In previous years, they had done investigations of individual box holders at U.S. private vaults. And when they did those investigations, they followed the proper procedures. You investigate, you get evidence as to that specific box and its owner, and you go ask for a warrant for that box. But that's not what they did here. Instead of trying to say what any individual did wrong, the FBI made the decision that anyone who rented at U.S. private vaults, just by dint of that, was criminally suspect and justified their taking of their property.
So that's fascinating, because the Fourth Amendment is obviously going to cover people who are doing things that they shouldn't. You can only tell when you violate it or when you get a warrant. But that's part of the deal, right? I mean, that's part of the deal that the government agrees to. So what you're saying here is that the FBI is, in this case, taking the view that to want to hide something is per se suspicious.
Exactly. And this is something that we've seen as a larger assault on financial privacy, financial security. You know, I'm allowed to have cash, and if I want to keep my cash in a box, I should be allowed to. That doesn't make me a suspect. That isn't criminal. It's a perfectly normal thing. And our clients reflected that. We had clients, one client, Joseph Ruiz, he didn't trust the banks. And so he put his money, it was settlements that he'd gotten from an accident, into his box at U.S. private vaults. And that was his sole money. He was using that to buy food and get medical care. And he was left destitute when the government seized all those funds in March 2021. In fact, Joseph showed up at U.S. private vaults and said, I'm not a criminal. I'd like to get my money. And they wouldn't let him. And instead, they started asking him if he's a cartel member. And we've seen this over and over again. They don't have any actual evidence of that you've done anything wrong. So they throw everything up against the wall just in hopes that something will stick.
There's really no limiting principle either, right? I have an iPhone in my pocket, and that iPhone is encrypted in various ways, which allows me to put information on it or to communicate with people in a way that the authorities would find very difficult to track. Is that inherently suspicious in the same way? Could the FBI say we have to take down Apple?
Well, to the FBI, anyone ever wanting security is suspicious. They would prefer, to be honest, a panopticon where everyone could be everything and everyone could be seen at all times. But that's just not what the Fourth Amendment dictates. It says we have the right to be secure in our persons and property, including our information. So if I want to use encryption in order to better secure my information, I'm allowed to do that. And there's nothing criminal or inappropriate about that. Here, these people had the right to financial privacy, just to store money or their gold, or in the case of some of our clients, you know, things like backup hard drives and flight logs. They have a right to do that without having the government turn their lives upside down. And that's what happened here. Hundreds, if not thousands of people's lives got turned upside down by what the FBI did.
So before we move on to how this case is proceeding, the case law, the potential for reform in Congress, I have to ask this. Do you think that the FBI did this as a money-raising exercise? I mean, the cynic would say yes, right? Because you obviously know that people who are using firms that secure your valuables are going to be securing valuables. And if you can, en masse, take those valuables and keep them, then you've just raised a whole bunch of money for yourself.
That's exactly right.
Is this a scheme?
Right.
Is this a conspiracy?
No, I know it sounds like a conspiracy, but it unfortunately, when we entered this case, pretty early, like immediately after the raid, before the government had been trying to forfeit people's property. My colleague and I, Rob Johnson, were seasoned forfeiture attorneys here at IJ, and we knew what their game plan was going to be. We fully expected them to send out a notice saying that they were going to try to forfeit everything that wasn't nailed down. And other experienced litigators as part of this just couldn't imagine that that would possibly be the case. Well, that's exactly what turned out to happen. And it's important to recognize that with civil forfeiture, these funds, if the FBI was successful in collecting this $100 million plus in gold, cash, and jewels, this isn't like this. That money would go into the general fund, into Treasury. No, no, no. It goes into a special dedicated fund at the Department of Justice, a dedicated fund that the FBI and those other federal law enforcement agencies have exclusive access to. So it's a very kind of eat what you kill system here, where they knew that if they were able to forfeit all this property, it would go into an account and those funds would be available to them.
So I had the same response to this story as the litigators you're describing, which is, no, that's not legal. Is it?
No, it's absolutely not legal. This is in my 15 years of litigation here at the Institute for Justice, this is the single most egregious violation of the Fourth Amendment I've ever seen. You're exactly right. Your intuition, I'm sure, is that when you want to take my stuff, you have to tell me what you think I did wrong. And that's not what the FBI did here. Instead, it decided to paint with a brush. It decided everyone here is just guilty by association. And we might not know what you did. We think just by dint of you being here, that's suspicious enough that we're going to try to keep your stuff forever and put it in our own pocket.
Right. So you made that case. I completely agree with you. I think most Americans would agree with you. I think the founders would agree with you. But the FBI has still done this, and they must think that they're going to get away with it, at least in part. Are they right to think that?
Well,
I mean, I'm not asking you to say, hey, I'm going to lose the case. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm asking you is, what is the case law here? What will they hang their case on? Because to me, it's self-evidently absurd. But they're going to go into court and they're going to say, no, because of this doctrine or these extenuating circumstances, we are allowed to do this.
Yeah. What they've argued the entire time is that, look, when the warrant said we couldn't do a criminal search and seizure, which this kind of looks exactly like. But no, that's not what we're doing. We're simply inventorying the property in order to return it to people. And they said, under this doctrine, this inventory doctrine, the fact that we might have the motive, dual motives, to both investigate people and return people's property doesn't make it impermissible. And that actually prevailed at the district court. The district court said everything they did was perfectly fine, but the story was quite different when we got up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. There, the Ninth Circuit was, to be honest, shocked at what the government had done. The panel, the three judges up there, didn't mince their words. They were calling this case egregious and outrageous. One judge likened it to the writs of assistance. Those were general warrants that officials were able to get and were one of the major causes of the American Revolution, the insecurity that they provided. And so what the Ninth Circuit said is that the district court, no, district court, this is wrong. You're wrong here. This wasn't an inventory search. And what the court said is that this was an inventory search for one simple reason. In an inventory search, you're supposed to use standardized procedures, you know, your ordinary FBI procedures. And that's so that you can't apply any discretion. You're supposed to do the job the way it's supposed to be. But what the panel recognized, the Ninth Circuit recognized, is that the FBI didn't use its standardized procedures. In fact, it created special bespoke one-time good-only procedures. And those procedures told agents, dig through the box, look for anything that looks like drug proceeds, mark the condition of the cash. If the cash looks like it's been associated with drugs, let us know. Run all the cash before drug-sniffing dogs to see if they alert. And the court said, like, look, when you put all this in, it's clear that your goal here is not to conduct an inventory, but to conduct a criminal search or seizure of these people's boxes. Something the warrant explicitly said you could not do. And so the Ninth Circuit, 3-0, said that what the government did here violated the Fourth Amendment rights of the hundreds of people who all rented at U.S. private vaults.
I want to talk about the Supreme Court and potential congressional legislation, but as an overture, I must ask, is this problem getting worse, or are we just hearing about it more?
This was, I would say, if we hadn't been able to act, I think this would be the shape of things to come. One thing that was interesting is that while we've been litigating this case, somebody sent us an email about, it's like a 14-year-old news story from London. And it turns out that the Metropolitan Police in London conducted a very similar raid about 14 years ago, where they saw a safe deposit box company and they broke it open and took all the boxes. And they thought, oh, well, it's going to be all criminals. And it turned out, no, it's not. Just like here, there are ordinary people who wanted to keep their property safe. And those people got lives got turned upside down, often having to prove their own property was legitimate in order to get it back. In order to prevent anything like that from ever happening here in America, that's why we stepped in. And hopefully the Ninth Circuit's ruling that makes in no uncertain terms clear that what the FBI did here was a egregious violation of constitutional rights should never happen again.
So there's two avenues that I can see for preventing this from happening, or at least regulating it preemptively. One is Supreme Court cases that determine what is and isn't permissible when it comes to civil asset forfeiture. And the other is federal law as passed by Congress. And unless I'm mistaken, you need both, in that the Supreme Court would take a case such as this and hopefully say, you're not allowed to do that. And it might come up with some standards as to how the FBI must behave next time it wants to look in these sorts of boxes. But then Congress would be more proactive, right? Congress would say, you're not allowed to give yourself this money, or the agencies are obliged to report more openly on what it is that they're doing or what you will. So if you were in charge of everything for a day, which of course we don't want. We don't want that in America. But just say, you got your heart's desire here. What would you have the courts rule, and what would you have Congress do?
The Supreme Court is a wonderful place, but they can only deal with one issue at a time. I would have the Supreme Court take a case to say that having agencies be able to keep the money, the eat what you kill system, where it goes into dedicated funds, creates an impermissible conflict of interest. Because after all, if you know that the money you're seizing and forfeiting is going to your budget, everybody likes to have a job. Everybody likes to have perks. They're going to bend justice in order to serve those institutional goals. But more importantly, I think Congress really has a place to act here. There's actually a bill right now called the FAIR Act that is in the House of Representatives. It cleared its committee. It's sort of striking. The FAIR Act would fix a lot of these problems. It would eliminate the profit incentive I talked about by directing all money into Treasury. It would mean that if people's property, the government tries to forfeit people's property, they have to see a real court instead of administrative forfeiture. We could get into that. That's a whole separate issue. And that people have a right to prompt post-seizure hearings. Once your stuff's taken, a lot of people, you get jammed up. Remember I told you about Joseph, where he was eating his COVID rations because he didn't have any money. A prompt post-seizure hearing would mean that you would have an immediate opportunity to see a real judge and say, give me my stuff back. You don't have any basis for holding it. In this world of very polarized world we live in now, that seems to be a strikingly bipartisan consensus. The FAIR Act, when it was in committee, passed out committee unanimously. And I think this is something that people on both the left and the right, really, regardless of your political persuasion, I think everybody can understand the idea that you shouldn't be taking property, people's property, people's valuables, unless you can actually charge and prove that they've committed a crime, and that agencies and officials shouldn't be able to eat what they kill, shouldn't be able to increase their own budgets and perks by going out and doing more seizing and forfeiting.
So obvious question then, if this is a bipartisan issue, if there aren't too many groups that are against it, if this is an exception to our polarized politics, why hasn't it passed Congress? It's not for a lack of examples of abuse.
No, it's not. And I did say it is very bipartisan, but there is one group that is very dedicated to stopping any and all forfeiture reform that they possibly can, and that's law enforcement. And the reason for that should be obvious. I've just sat here talking for 20 minutes about how under these forfeiture systems, the agencies get to keep the money and use it however they wish. The same is true for like state and local officials. There's a program called Equitable Sharing, where state and local officials who seize property can say, you know what, I think this could be forfeited under federal law. Let's say they're in a state that has really good forfeiture laws, like New Mexico, where policing for profit's completely banned. They could say something like, well, I'll send this to the feds instead. And under this equitable sharing program, once the feds forfeit the property, the state and local officials get 80% of it, of the value. And it has to go dedicated to just their accounts. So there's a massive financial interest on the part of law enforcement. And that's why they have fought against forfeiture reform tooth and nail at every step.
I want to ask you about the history. I said somewhat glibly, well, the founders would have hated this. And I'm sure they would. But how soon in the Republic did this start? What is the history of civil asset forfeiture? Is it a modern invention, or has this been a problem throughout American history that the Fourth Amendment was designed to prevent right from the start?
Well, forfeiture's origins in the United States are really... They're really rather narrow. During the early days of the New Republic, most of our revenue came from customs and tariffs and things like that. And so there would be custom officers, and some people would try to smuggle and go around the custom officers. And forfeiture would be used in the limited situations where you would find a boat a ship that had been trying to evade customs, but you couldn't get access to the owner. The owner was in another jurisdiction, maybe another country. And so it was by the necessity of the case, said the Supreme Court, that you would go after the ship. And we saw this a little bit. There was a little bit of forfeiture activity during the Civil War. We started seeing a little bit more during Prohibition. But when it really took center stage was in the mid-80s during the War on Drugs. And that's because, and here's the critical thing, in 1984, Congress passed a law, a new forfeiture law. And that law was the first one that did the policing for profit that I'm talking about. It was the first time where the law said agencies could keep the funds for themselves rather than send them to the general fund. And once that incentive got established, the amount of civil forfeiture activity in the United States started skyrocketing, you know, going up by factors of 4, 5, 10 times. At this point now, we're at forfeiture is a multi-billion dollar industry. There are entire companies set up to train officers about how to more effectively seize and forfeit property. It's an entire cottage industry that's set up in order to essentially fleece people of their savings, often for no real reason at all.
Yeah, it seems to me that it also violates a couple of other parts of our Constitution, Lorden. I'm not saying that it does so in a way that would be enforceable by the courts, but the United States Constitution is predicated upon the assumption that men are ambitious and that they will be self-interested and that self-interest needs to be harnessed and offset by other self-interest. If you allow people to engage in asset forfeiture that they get to keep, then you are handing them both the power and the incentive without a check or a balance. And the other element here that seems to me to be problematic, again, even if not necessarily justiciable, is that this undermines the traditional appropriations process. In a system of free government, you would want the police or any agent of the state to have its budget controlled by the legislature or by the public in some sense. But if these organizations, the FBI and so forth, and local police forces get to keep the money that they go after, then have they not divorced themselves in some way from the democratic process?
Absolutely. There's a massive, in addition to the due process problems that I've been talking about, the unfairness of it all, there are forfeiture, the civil forfeiture scheme that we have in the United States greatly threatens separation of powers. One of the basic ideas is that you're never supposed to combine the powers of the purse and the sword together, that those should be separate. But that's exactly what forfeiture does. It combines the two. It says to these law enforcers, you go out, you collect your own money, you go into your own account, you get to use it, and nobody has any oversight about what you do with it. As long as you use it for a law enforcement purpose, whatever that is, you're fine. And you're right. It creates a huge problem with appropriations. How does a legislature keep control over a self-funded executive? What leverage do they have on them? But at the end of the day, our elected representatives are supposed to be running the show, not our civil servants. And it's another fundamental reason why we need to end this policing for profit and get back to standard budgeting. Of course, the police should have the funds that they need to be able to effectively fight crime. And those funds should come from the general public rather than some poor, unfortunate souls who happen to get in their crosshairs.
Is there a split in the courts by judicial philosophy on this question? Do you go into these cases aware that certain ideological positions will have an effect on the outcome, or are judges at the Supreme Court and elsewhere somewhat unified on this as well?
I would say that there are probably some marginal issues where there might be some disagreement. For instance, like Justice Alito might be more sympathetic to forfeiture at least in some aspects of it, than Justice Gorsuch. I wouldn't know. We haven't had an issue, a forfeiture issue, squarely decided by them, although one is up at the court right now. I don't think that this is an issue so much of a political difference. And one thing I've always said about this is that when you're talking about forfeiture, this red versus blue, that doesn't matter. The only matter, the color matters here is green, the color of money, because that's what drives a lot of it. And I think everybody can come to be outraged by civil forfeiture for their own reasons. You know, a conservative might think of it as an assault on property rights. A progressive might look at it and say, oh, well, look at how this disproportionately harms minorities and the poor, which it does. So I think there's, no matter what your political sympathies might be, there is something about civil forfeiture that will outrage you.
To be outraged, you have to know that something is happening. How aware is the public of this trend? I mean, I've just said to you that when I read this, when I heard you tell your story, I just thought, well, obviously that's illegal. That's appalling. But I work in politics, and I spend time reading about this sort of thing and reading about the law. Do you think there is a widespread understanding that this is going on, or are we still at the early stages of informing voters?
It's funny you say that. For about a decade now, one of my stump lines has always been to people, you know, there are only two kinds of people in the world regarding civil forfeiture: the people who don't know about civil forfeiture and the people who are mad about civil forfeiture. But I think it's something that needs to keep getting hammered home, that these people at U.S. private vaults, they were anybody. That could have been you. It could have been me. As we see people become more and more aware about what forfeiture truly is, we see increased public opposition to it.
Here's my last question. If I were the FBI, or if I were a local police department, one of the PR tactics that I would employ is to tell voters that if civil asset forfeiture is reined in or effectively outlawed in its current form, their taxes are going to go up. That it's much better to take this money from criminals. Now, we know they're only accused, but I'm in this example playing devil's advocate.
Yes.
And that this is unfair because it means that hardworking people are going to have to fork over more money to protect people who are doing something wrong. First off, how effective do you think that message would be? And second, is it actually true that the amounts would lead to a shift in taxation or in budgets?
Well, let me take the second one sure. First, which is it wouldn't really. And when these funds are put into these dedicated accounts, they're not being used for day-to-day operations. They're generally not used for like standard salaries or ordinary capital. What they're used for are, as one officer said, they're pennies from heaven that let them buy goodies. You know, so you see a lot of people buy Bearcats or, you know, those armored vehicles or fancy new toys. Hell, we have some jurisdictions that have bought things like Zambonis and margarita machines with the forfeiture money. So I don't think it's accurate to say that if you end policing for profit that the ordinary citizen's tax bill is going to go up. And I think more fundamentally, the idea that we can pick some people and just saddle them with all the costs that should truly be borne by everybody just strikes me as like fundamentally un-American. If they had to like destroy a house, for instance, in order as part of an armed standoff, I don't think we would want that poor, unfortunate soul who didn't do anything but whose house destroyed to be the one who's sort of left out of luck. And I think it's the same thing here. If we want law enforcement, and we should want law enforcement, that should be paid by the community as a whole, not saddled upon a few hapless souls.
So where can people find more out about this case and the work you're doing on it?
Well, the best place to go would be our website. That is www.ij.org. There, if you want to find out more about the case we've been discussing, it's the U.S. Private Vaults case. And if you want to find out more generally about civil forfeiture and what you can do to help bring this nightmare to an end, please go check out nforfeiture.com. That's our dedicated page on civil forfeiture.
Rob Frohman, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all we've got time for this week. I was going to say thank you to various people at this point, but unfortunately, the FBI stole them all.